podcast is part of the Podcast You're Seeing Network. Visit us at www.podcastyourseeing.com.
Media has an agenda that they're gonna serve. I don't know who's in charge of it or what it is, if it's like a headless monster.
Why? This is a question.
Walking backwards. Yeah. Something sacred.
I don't know the names of the creep songs. Those
running
are
in circles.
Just pop in and let play.
Sea of Glass.
The Flight and the Fall.
I love Ozzy. I think he's the true definition of a rock star.
Anybody else have any interesting stories they don't want to come to
talk? Come after the ball.
Hey, this is John Lane from the thriving metropolis of Leechburg, Pennsylvania.
The Pennsylvania Rock Show, featuring the best unsigned rock that Pennsylvania has to offer.
Hey, it's Bill, and you're tuned into the Pennsylvania Rock Show, the best unsigned rock and metal that Pennsylvania has to offer, right here on PARockShow.com, MegaRockRadio.net, 107.1 FM St. Louis, Missouri, AltRockRadio.ca up near Toronto, Canada, on the western coast of the Pennsylvania, of the United States. We have RootaRootRadio.com, and across the pond, we have XRPRadio.co.uk. This is episode number 544, and with me tonight is Joel Miller, author of Memoir of a Roadie. What's up, Joel?
How you doing, man? That's a long one there.
It is.
You got it memorized too. How many episodes in was it until you were like, I got this?
Well, it often changes too. So you throw a wrench in the cogs.
Keep you busy.
Wow. Yeah, this one is 544 episodes, and then I have another podcast. So I just literally took like a day to read your book, which is amazing for me because usually I don't do that kind of thing anymore.
I'm impressed with your literacy level.
Thank you. I started reading it at 10:30 on Friday night, approximately 10:30. At 2:10, my wife made me go to bed.
Oh, the choice of marriage.
And I got up again right around 8 a.m., which is when I sent you the Facebook message telling you that I had made it halfway through already. It was very, first of all, let's tell everybody the premise behind the book. I'll let you give a little bit of inside information.
So the book is called Memoir of a Roadie. And initially it was actually called Axel Said I Made a Great Cup of Tea. And then people were saying, that doesn't, you know, we don't know what your book's about. And I'm like, I don't care. but I wanted the tongue in cheek. I wanted it to be funny. My goal was to make the reader laugh, hopefully quite a lot. But that's the goal, is to get a couple chuckles and to put something together that doesn't really – I'm not trying to cause waves. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm not trying to get you the dirty scoop on the nastiness of rock and roll. More I like music, and so it's more of a way of just saying, you know, here's a book from some kid who liked music. I like music. So it's a coming of age story about me being a roadie. And I started touring when I was 23 years old by a few days. And it's an unusual way to grow up. It's a cool way to grow up. And the whole premise really is me trying to find my way to possibly becoming a man. And then, are you a man roadie? Which I don't know, is that feather in the hat? Or are you a regular, a good person in society? So there's my terrible thing, because it's not very concise. But nonetheless, that's pretty much what the book's about.
The first question I had, if you read the review, and those of you that probably may or may not have read it yet, it is right here on the screen if you're watching the video. It's buildascene.com/memoir-of-a-roadie. One of the things that I mentioned was that I was sharing the titles as I was reading it. I was sending it to people in the music scene. I'm like, look at this chapter title. So my question to you is, how quickly did those titles come to you? And like, did you really have to think about them, or was it just quick? Like, okay,
quick. It takes a long time to write a book, but the chapter titles were actually quicker than you'd think. Cause, I got a couple that I think are great. You know, the Donald Trump, whatever, does the carpet match the, yeah. You know, there's a few I'm sitting there, you know, I'm laughing away to myself. I don't know if anybody else thinks it's funny. I don't know, but I sure did. So I'm sitting there chuckling away, coming up with some of the titles. And I had fun with the titles. That was one of the more enjoyable parts of it. Because, you know, when you're putting your own book together, you can do whatever you want. So I had fun with that part. Yeah, I liked it.
I also liked the roadie ramble sections where you just kind of went off on a tangent on something, and I don't want to give too much information away on them.
I don't think you are. Yeah, I mean, the intent there was, I don't know, I wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to, and it is, they're completely separate than what the rest of the book's about. And I'm trying to create like a little bit of a break. And then when you go back to it, it's cool, but you get a chuckle or maybe an insight, but most of them are chuckles. And I also think it's kind of who I am. I'm kind of a tangent person anyway. I go off on this side and then I'll bring it back around if I remember and I'm not drunk. I'll bring it back in. But that was the idea, the roadie ramble moments. And those were fun for me. I enjoyed writing a lot of those. I thought they were hilarious in my own twisted head.
So this one, this is a tangent for me outside of the book, sort of. My dad is a huge fan of Jay Leno's Garage.
Oh, okay.
And my dad actually has rebuilt a 1931 Ford Model A Victoria, a 1937 Ford T-U-D-O-R. I can't pronounce that for some reason. And a 1955 Ford Crown Victoria. And he, when my kids and I go to his house, he's always pulling up different car shows and saying, check out the car that so-and-so was working on, or check out this episode of Jay Leno's Garage. And his garage on that show is huge. And it's just car after car after car. Yeah. Is that really what it's like?
Well, I hadn't been to his garage since I was a kid, and he had an airplane bunker when I was a kid. And yeah, it's huge. It's an airplane bunker. But since then, I think he's built his own thing. But I haven't been there as an adult, so I'm not really sure what he's going on. But I'm sure he's got so many cars. The guy's never sold a car in his life. It's amazing. He's a really true enthusiast. He loves it. Loves everything about him. He thinks they're really cool. He's a good guy. I like him. I think he's a good dude.
One of the cool things in the book is your interactions that you had with the various band members. And before reading it, I actually thought that it was going to be more like a feudal system where like the band never talked to roadies and the roadies never talked to. And I was surprised to see.
We're all scumbags. we're all on the bottom of your list. We all stick together, man.
Were there any interactions that you could tell us about that didn't make the cut in the book?
Huh. While eating, you're saying, or just in general?
Just in general.
You know, there was a bit of a fun one. Somebody asked me in another interview, have you, who would you be starstruck by, or who, when do you see a celebrity? And it's really far and few between, but I was at a bar on Sunset. And at the time I was actually working for Guns N' Roses, and the bar was owned by the drummer from the Police's brother, who passed away now. And it was called The Backstage. And I was in there with a big group of girls. And or women, I should say, a big group of women. And we were hanging out, and in comes Jimmy Page. And it's not like he's hiding with a beard or anything. It's just totally straight Jimmy Page. And I'm looking and I'm kind of like, whoa. And so he's coming in, he's talking to the dude. And my girlfriend at the time, she's like, I'm like, it's Jimmy Page. And she's like, yeah. And she came from Santa Barbara. So she's sitting there, and I'm like, Stairway to Heaven, and she's like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So Jimmy Page comes and sits at the table I'm at, and I'm thinking, oh my God, and even Axl Rose would have been like, oh wow, Jimmy Page. So he sits down at the table, and there's maybe 10 women at the table. He shakes everyone's hand but me, but I'm at the far end.
Okay.
Weird, but I'm sitting there like, oh man, I wanted to shake Jimmy Page's hand. So he sits down, he's hanging out, we're all just chatting for a bit. And this lady, she's like, I was one of your groupies back in the early 70s or 60s. And he gets up and he leaves. And I'm looking at her like, you scared Jimmy Page away, lady. You scared Jimmy Page away. And then years later, I was working with a Toad the Wet Sprocket. They're a band out of Santa Barbara. And the girl I was dating, she's like, Toad the Wet Sprocket, she's like, I went to high school with them. So she was starstruck. So I was writing, his name's Dean, he's the bass player of the band. And and so I'm like, dude, I mean, you're bigger than Jimmy Page, bro. So I'm like, Stairway who? Toad the Wet Sprocket. Woo! So I don't know, that one's fun. That's a little bit of it. Yeah, it's a good one.
I alluded to this question when we were off the air. I ask bands all the time that if I was on tour with them, what kind of music would we listen to in between sets or in between shows? And one of the things that kept coming up in your book was like when the crew and the band were being picked up to go from the hotel to the venue or venue to somewhere else, the drivers were always playing that band's music, and that really wasn't what they wanted to happen. So,
well, the driver initially didn't want to be in it. They thought they were picking up the band always, and instead they were with us idiots. And so they were always kind of like, well, you know, it's like the band, like, am I picking up the band after, dude? So I guess unless you're in Canada or some other country, maybe they don't say that. But anyway, yeah, they would always be playing, like STP, for example. They'd be playing the tape of STP and you're getting in their passenger van thinking like, oh, man. But it's also because you're expecting it, because they all do it. They would all do it.
So once you conveyed to them that you didn't want to listen to that.
I never did. I never really said anything. Yeah, whatever. Just get me to the hotel. I don't care. Get away from these dickheads and go eat dinner and, you know, watch a movie. But yeah, I would sometimes be like, but I mean, honestly, we were really rude. Just say, hey, would you mind just turning that off?
So it usually just got turned off. Nothing else got played in this place.
Not that I really remember. Nothing that stands out. I mean, it would have been funny if, like, the guy picks us up playing Liberace and you're with Ministry or something. That would have been kind of entertaining. But none of that really stands out. You know, it would have been cool, too. It's like, oh, here's my band. And you got the kid playing his unsigned band. But none of that really. Although there was quite a few CDs and stuff that I remember picking up on stage that people throw up there hoping that one of the musicians would get hold of it. And I listened to a few of them, just looking for stuff to do. So,
there was a story towards the end of the book where, you played the same song 10 times on the jukebox.
Yeah. So it was, the story in the book is I'm in New York and I'm in a bar in New York City. And, I said that already. What is it? Times Square. That's what I meant to say. And it's busy. You're in Times Square. And this fella, the bartender, the song comes on the radio with Arms Wide Open. It's Creed, right?
Creed, yeah.
Guy just goes, I hate this band. I hate this band. It gets so pissed so quick, though. Like, boom, he was so mad. So I got up and I played with Arms Wide Open 10 times in a row. But because you're in a New York bar that's very full, I didn't think about it. And it's like, well, how long is it going to be until they actually play any of my stuff? And I don't know nobody there. So the guy sitting next to me, he's in a suit, but everybody's in a suit. And I'm like, oh, watch this. Cut this. Cut. So it took, I want to say, I think about an hour. And they started playing with the Arms Wide Open. And this guy, he got so mad. Dude. And he's like, you were saying you're a teacher. And I remember when I was a kid, see, it told you tangents. When I was a kid, they were throwing the stink bombs where it's glass and it breaks and it smells like.
Oh, rain. Yeah.
And the guy's like, I don't care. I teach science. You know, I can handle it longer than you guys can. And so this guy did the same thing with Creed. He was just like, all right, you know what? If you guys want to listen to this crappy song, I'll listen to it too. I don't care. I don't care. So I'm watching him. He's like turning bright red. And then he's like, no. Nah. And then he turns the song anyway. There's like a kill switch where you can just go to the next track. And it just worked out well. And the guy next to me ended up being the owner of the bar. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, man. And he's like, no, that was great. And he was picking up my tab. And I met a cool guy at a bar. And it was very random, but it was cool.
So we just had a question pop up from the viewers. And I'm going to throw it up on the screen.
Okay.
Michael Ruska wants to know how many times you saw This Is Spinal Tap while on the bus.
It would be great. I feel like we might have once. We might have. The big deal on the bus was the Crocodile Hunter at the time. Crocodile Hunter was serious. And then there was a, what is it? Not a puppeteer, right? It's a guy it was a Vegas guy, Jim's, very rude, very, very, very.
Oh, ventriloquist?
Ventriloquist guy. And that man, they were into it. Everyone was into that. But the Crocodile Hunter was serious business. We'd have it playing in the front lounge and the back lounge. People loved the Crocodile Hunter. But I like Spinal Tap. I think Spinal Tap's great. And in one of the other interviews I did, and the guy asked me, he's like, you know, what's with putting the tape on the stage? I'm like, well, you know, you don't want the guy to fall off the stage. So you put tape. I'm thinking it's not the most interesting question. And I tried to make it funny because I told him it's funny because these bands, when they were indie bands, they'd play on little stages. And I don't, how often did they fall off? I don't know. But here we are in big, big places and I got to tape it. But I'd have to do the arrows from the dressing room to the stage. And sometimes the dressing room was like right on the stage. And I'd put an arrow anyway. just walk out the door, rock star. Just walk out the door. Yeah, there's 30,000 people. Lo and behold, it's time to go. And I felt super Spinal Tap there. And then there's an NSYNC thing there where we go through M&Ms and we're picking up the colored M&Ms. But we were doing it intentionally. The guy had a busted leg, I think. One of the dudes in the band. So actually, is NSYNC a band? I don't know. Performer? Whatever they are. So, but yeah, we were picking up the colored M&Ms.
You hear about those riders all the time and legends of riders. Was there anything in the riders with the bands you worked with that was just really off the wall? Like the M&M one comes up, you hear that a lot, but.
We had, so with us, with STP, we had Yoohoo, which was random because I guess Yoohoo had sponsored them at some time or something to do with Yoohoo. So we're getting a case of Yoohoo at every show and we just shove it on the bus and nobody ever really thought about it. So I started drinking Yoohoo. It's really good. But and then we had beer, but honestly, like STP wasn't a heavily drinking tour. Nobody really, so they just kept stuffing under the bus. So when we got to Los Angeles, which was home, I took so many cases of Yoohoo and beer home. And but no, I mean, a lot of times I found like with the really big bands, they're kind of cool about it. Towels, it's actually a big deal to have some towels. So we'd have towels and just water, like the necessary stuff in the dressing room. And I assume, and I really think a lot of bands go through an arc, and the arc would be, hey, we're awesome right now. And we got a private plane and we're going to ask for silly things. And then I think you get past that. And then it's a little more respect of like, yeah, I mean, if we could get some towels and some water, you're back to your roots. We'd be happy things though. You know, or we have a private chef, so we don't need you anyway.
The T story with Axl, I find that person, they had one person that went to Rio to make tea.
Yeah, he was the tea guy, and he didn't make it. He actually missed his plane, so he never got there to make the tea. I made the tea, and I know it's in the book title. It was very funny how this tea thing had become this, like, there was this Guns N' Roses forum and they're talking, it transitioned into like, what kind of tea does Axl drink? And I'm kind of thinking like, you really care? But, like, what'd you do with your tea? I'm like, well, I was 23 years old or whatever. I don't know. I put a lot of sugar in it. Lemons, and he's like, that's some good tea. And so I'm friendly with Dizzy. Dizzy's the keyboard player. You were mentioning keyboard players earlier. Dizzy's the keyboard player for Guns. And he's been with Guns, I want to say, since like 1991, 92. So a really long time. And we're pretty friendly. He's a good fella. And so when I talked to him, I'm like, yeah, so the book, it's called Axl Cinema, A Great Cup of Tea. And he said, that's like the best name you come up with for your book? I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good, right? And he's going, well, why? I'm like, well, I only really had two conversations with Axl. And the first one was like, hey, dude, can you make me some tea? And then afterwards, he drank the tea and he's like, hey, man, he goes, that was some good tea. And Dizzy's like, well, I mean, that's like one conversation, Joel. Well, it was a different time. So I consider it two conversations. So he's like, all right, whatever. So I don't know. And my couple of my buddies, the guy who did the graphics and stuff for the book, the front cover, he's like, that's the best title ever. I'm like, it's in. This is what we're doing. We're doing it. So we ended up using that. But yeah, there was a guy to make him tea. And then the guy, I don't know, he never showed up. He never went to Rio. So, but I made the tea in, it was actually here in the States. I never made tea in Rio. I've lost my tea making privileges.
Speaking of Rio, you kind of got grounded when you were there.
Yeah, I got in trouble. So what happened was a couple guys on the crew, they wanted to go see what a favela is. Now, a favela is where it's some of the worst slums there are in the world, if not the worst. And we walked through this favela. Well, the only reason to go in there would be to get drugs. And so I had kept my money, my per diem money. I had like a couple grand, I think. I kept it on my person. I was worried about leaving it in the hotel. And so I'm walking through this slum with a lot of money. And when we got out, these cops, they stripped us down naked in the middle of the street where there's like hundreds of cars driving by. And they're giving us honks, as they should, right? Because we look great. Buff, I'm looking amazing. And I'm holding all this money in my hand. And I was just thinking, I'm just going to run if the guy tries to take my money, which is the dumbest thing anybody could do. But luckily, nothing really happened. So we get back and we go to the pool. Everybody kind of hung out at the pool at the hotel. It's a safe spot. And I'm telling people how we walked through this favela and these cops had stripped us naked. And so when my boss heard about it, he was really, really, really mad at me. And so I was stuck. I said I had to stay at the pool every day or go to the rehearsal studio, which I had to do every night. But I'd sit at the pool every day and drink beer. And it was this horrible.
With the band, right?
with all the bands. Yeah, it was the Foo Fighters and Papa Roach. And we all just drank all day. It was a very difficult job. I'm telling you, man, this was tough. This was really tough. It was a terrible time.
That's I have a mission to interview Dave Grohl. And every so often I tag the Foo Fighters and, you know, or I'll put out a status saying I want to talk to Dave Grohl. I've never ever gotten a response, but
he's a really nice guy. I mean, honestly, if you were in the right place, I'd be surprised if you wouldn't be able to. And he's funny. He's a lot funnier than me. He's a funny fellow. He's on it. He's a good dude too. A lot of these guys they're good people. I think a lot of people in music I like. I think they're cool. We got a lot of together. It's this guy asking again. I was on tour with GNR Metallica. I wish I was, but I think when they did that tour, I was in high school. So I did see Metallica play once. It's okay, right, to jump and answer this, Bill? Yep. I'll step on your toes. Okay,
nope, you're good.
Okay. I did see Metallica play once. They were playing with STP, and you get that feel. I'm not a huge guy. I'm like, I'll say 5'9", because we're on sort of TV. I don't know. I was being recorded, so I'm 5'9". So, I don't know, man. I'm 5'8", and I just feel like somebody bigger is behind you, you know? And I turn around, and it was Lars behind me, and I'm sitting there and I'm kind of turning. I'm like, oh shit. I look around, there's Kirk Hammett, and I'm surrounded by Metallica, you know, and I'm just kind of like, oh, and then James Hetfield was there. He's like, I'm on your way, brother. You know, kind of looking up like, you fucking Metallica, man. Hey. They sat there and they watched STP play. But it was cool because they all watched the whole set. They watched STP play. And I talk about it in the book. And it is, for me, it was a big deal. I felt like I was special. Because the band I was working for, everybody wanted to see, including guys like Metallica, you know. And why would James Hetfield want to watch another show of anybody? But when they do, it makes you as a fan, because you're sitting there going, these guys have toured for years, and they're like some of the best musicians in the world. And if they're wanting to watch it, boy, are you in some lucky shoes today. What an opportunity you got. It makes you feel cool about it all. I would love to have seen that tour though, man. That would have been so cool.
Just because we haven't mentioned all the bands, why don't you go ahead and mention all the bands that you worked as a roadie for real quick?
So I was on the actual payroll for them with the Stone Temple Pilots. It's hard because I go through them all, but it doesn't mean I actually was hired by them. So it's STP, Guns N' Roses, The Cranberries, NSYNC, Bush a little bit, all gave me paychecks. But then I toured with the Chili Peppers and Godsmack and Disturbed and a lot of these opening bands. All, you know, and I, some of the times actually you're friendlier with some of those guys than you are with whatever, because you're all together. Poison. Yeah, I was on Poison's payroll too. That's a biggie. I don't know why I forgot. Yeah,
I actually looked that up after reading the book, because you talked about the 4th of July and being in the parking lot watching the extra fireworks. And I saw Poison live on the 4th of July in Pittsburgh, and I was like, it can't be that show.
And so I looked
it up. It wasn't. It was mine was in 2004. So,
oh, yeah, no, that's after me. It's probably still the Glam Slam Summer Jam, was it?
I mean, and the thing is, Brett and I think Ricky are both from this area. Brett is from Butler, where the driving that I was talking about.
I'm trying to remember, because Jerry from Warrant went to high school with Brett. So I think you'll find that he is too. But yeah, I think Ricky is from Pennsylvania. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think Ricky is somewhere closer to Pittsburgh than Brett was. I'd have to look it up again, but Yeah, that's a little less than an hour to both of those areas. So
yeah, that's cool.
But Brett was really fired up that day because he was back home.
Oh, I bet. He's like nice guy of the century too. He loves what he does. He likes people. He's an all around really good dude. And I'm sure he was super happy to be back home because if I remember then, if it is Pennsylvania, yeah, he'd have lots of family come. He'd invite everybody, all his old friends. He'd invite tons of people to come to the show and, you know, catch up with his buddies and his family. This was the thing I tried to convey to, you know, these guys are people. they're people. And, they said to me, you know, when you sit down for dinner, what is it like? And it's like, well, you're just, you know, you're eating dinner, you're buds. And then when your buddy goes perform, you're like, wow, my buddy's really talented though. My buddy's more talented than your buddy. He can play guitar really good. So, but yeah.
So you did some work in the film industry too. Do you want to touch on that?
Yeah, if you want me to. So coming out of LA, it's not unusual to get a job working in film. I didn't really like it. I was what's called a set dresser. So anything an actor touches is a prop. Everything else is set dressing. Truthfully, it's like furniture mover is probably a better way to call it the job. And I didn't like it. So I was moving crap around all the time. And then found the film industry people kind of weird. So
you went from moving stuff around all the time to moving stuff around all the time.
Heavier stuff around all the time. But we get wheels and we push that heavy stuff. It was really, yeah, actually it is kind of what lent itself. So what happened was, is when this Nigel in the book came and tried to hire me, that was it. I had some experience working in film by putting stuff up and down, and they needed a grunt to help out with things. And that's really kind of how it all worked together. But after music stuff, I made a movie and I went back to the film world. And I was doing this interview and they asked me, they're like, you know, so what's the big difference between film and music? I'm like, well, in music, you guys do a little bit of blow and you think you're all cool. But in music, we do heroin till we die.
and some of them come back.
We come back and we keep playing more. No, but then I might have messed it up. Did I say film? The first one's supposed to be in film. And you guys do a little bit of blow and you think you're all cool. I don't know if I messed it up. But anyway, that was the joke, and I thought that was really fitting. But I was just more of a music guy. I've always enjoyed music more than film.
When you were out on the road, what was the hardest thing about being on those tours?
It doesn't sound cool, but it's lonely. It's really lonely. So as I started to get older and get more comfortable in my shoes touring, I didn't know if it was what I wanted to do because I was getting lonely. There wasn't anyone around you. Things happen back at home. People get married, people die, people, you know, get a new car, I don't know, and you're missing all of it. And I thought, well, maybe when I get older, if I do have a family, I'm never gonna see them. Is this what I want to do? And as it was really developing into a actual career and not just a cool experience, I started to think, maybe I should think about whether I want to do this forever. So not the coolest answer, but it's true.
What was your favorite venue that you set up at and why? What about it excited you? Okay.
So there's a few. So basically, I really liked the people in New Jersey. It was at, what's the name of the place? The PNC Arts Center in New Jersey. It doesn't matter because they changed the names anyway. I doubt it's even called that anymore. But I liked that venue because it was a lot of the stagehands were family. And they were really nice people. It was a dad and his dad and his grandpa and his daughter. I loved that. And I thought that was really neat. Pine Knob, they changed the name. But if you're from the Detroit area, it's always will always be Pine Knob.
That's like Star Lake here in Pittsburgh.
For sure.
Are you familiar with Star Lake?
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, the Star Lake Pavilion.
Yep.
Yeah, no, they can change it to wherever they want, whatever they want to call the places, but that's what it is. So, and that's actually a cool spot too. But I like
that's where Pine I Knob. Saw Poison.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, I like Pine Knob. I just awesome audiences. You could be the worst wannabe musician ever, and they're still like, dude, you're badass. You're a badass. You. So the Detroit people are great, and then visually, Santa Barbara Bowl is incredible. Jones Beach is awesome. It's a beautiful place to see a show, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a few different, but the one that stood out first was that one. It was the PNC Arts Center in New Jersey. And I just loved how the whole, it was a family deal. And because you're all working with your family, there's a level of respect. There's a level of appreciation. It was really nice. I loved going there.
I know being out there and it being a job, you probably didn't get to see a lot of the cities while you were there. But you did have some time off occasionally in between shows. What was your favorite city to go out and just visit?
I hate to keep going back to Detroit, but there was a bookshop in Detroit. It was a three-story like bookshop. And I'm actually now an art dealer and I deal with a lot of memorabilia. And this bookshop was just filled with all this cool stuff. So I loved going there. And when we were in Detroit, I tried to get out in the middle of the day and go check out this three-story cool bookshop downtown. New Orleans is so much fun. New Orleans is great. New York is an amazing city. If you can get some time, Adirondack Mountains are awesome. Niagara Falls is cool. Buffalo, man. Oh, I had a lot of fun in Buffalo. There's one street where all these bars are at and you party. That was great. oh my God. I don't remember any of it, but I'm telling you, it's fun. It was fun. there's cities. Pompano Beach is fun. Pompano Beach is a cool place to hang out. There's a lot of places. We're in America. America's a great place. There's a lot of awesome cities. There's a lot of neat stuff to do.
My family took a bus tour of New York City two summers ago. And bus / walking. Like they would park and you get off. But we drove past Madison Square Garden. I was so excited. I didn't even get to go in it. I was like, it's Madison Square Garden. And we just kept going.
I did that when I was in Rome. They met these two dudes from Boston, right? And they're like, because Rome wasn't built in a day, so they wanted to see all of Rome in one day. So I'm like, I'm in. And these guys, they woke up in the morning and they just did push-ups for like 2 hours. It was two brothers. So I'm just sitting there as they're doing all these push-ups. And then we booked it. It's amazing how much of Rome you can see in one day. We cruised. We saw a lot. It was fun. It was like you're saying. It was like, and there you go. See it? I'm like, I saw it. Peter. It was really big. Okay, we're going now. We're going. I'm like, okay, we're going.
Were there any moments while you were out on the road where you were just like, you were sitting and you were like, I can't believe that I'm sitting here and this is happening?
I love seeing Ozzy. I love watching Ozzy perform. And I love just seeing Ozzy. He would sit on the side of the stage and he'd watch STP every performance. And he'd just sit there like this. And he just doesn't blink. He just stares with these big eyes. And then at the end, he just gets up and walks away. It was like amazing. I'm thinking like, what's going on in his head? Is he thinking like, hell yeah. Or is he just kind of thinking like, I need dinner. I want chicken. I want a big piece of chicken. Like, so I love just watching Ozzy. He was really interesting to me. That being said, Jack was a little boy. And so Jack went to a lot of the shows. He had like a little scooter and he'd scoot around. And it was cool to see the families of some of these people and their kids. I think getting raised like normally, you know, they're all hanging out. That was pretty cool. Howard Stern, I thought that was pretty neat. I like Howard Stern. So he came to quite a few STP shows. And he's actually very nice. He was super cool. I had lunch sitting next to Howard Stern. And so I was like, oh, that's pretty neat. So
You mentioned that you're an art dealer now. That's actually what you went to school for, right? You went art history or?
Yeah, I don't know how much they really worked together, but yeah, I studied art history, if you want to call it that, but yeah. And I got into art. My father was a car mechanic, hence the Jay Leno stuff, the high level, and he collected Japanese prints. And so then I got a couple bucks together. My dad had passed away. I thought, you know, maybe I'll keep the family thing alive, and I started buying art. It happened to be a lot of modern stuff. And then I sold some of it and I did real good. And I had just met my current girlfriend. So this was like 10 years ago. And I don't know. She's like, just stick with that, you know, because you're not too bright. And you're making money buying the art. Maybe you should focus on that, you know? So I was like, okay, you know, focus. So I had this big pillar and it was painted like the Jamaican flag, right? And I put my beer on it when we played pool. And there's a few things you look for. This is totally a tangent from music, so if it gets boring, just say speed it up. But we have a gallery tag. So gallery tag on a piece is awesome. It gives a piece provenance. So this had early gallery tag, which is great. It was from the late 50s or very early 60s. I can't remember. And that's good stuff. And so I take it to this dude. He's a LA Modern Auctions. His name was Peter Lochry. He passed away this year. He was on the Antiques Roadshow, and he was a great guy. He was my mentor. And so he was looking at it, and he goes, "You know, this is just awesome. This, you know, this wooden pillar that you put your beer on." And so he's like, "Well, the artist actually lives in LA, and maybe he can fix it up a bit. It's got a few nicks here and there." I'm like, "Oh yeah." So I drive it down to meet this dude. His name is Vasa Milovic, Vasa. And he's a teacher, actually. He's a professor at UCLA. And so I get there, and the dude, he just starts crying. And I've got his little Pomeranian dog. I'm sitting there holding his dog, and the guy's crying his eyes out, looking at this wooden pillar. I'm like, maybe you told him about the beer. It was the first piece he sold as an artist when he moved here from, I think, Romania or Yugoslavia or something. And so it was like, you know, it's coming to me at the end of my life. It's full circle. He's like, "Don't touch it. Don't touch it. Leave it as it is." I'm like, "Okay." You know, so I hand him back his dog. I go back to the auction house. And the guy said, "Just don't touch it, man." He was crying and stuff. And the thing sold pretty well. I made like $5,000-$6,000 on this pillar. But it was a super cool experience. I really enjoyed it. I liked meeting this artist guy. And so I stuck with it, and I started to do really well. And then I got into memorabilia. I bought Granny Clampett's outfit from the Beverly Hillbillies. And that opened a whole new world. That sold gangbusters. And so then I started buying other stuff. And now I do some music memorabilia, actually. So I have the original handwritten sheet music right now for Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Awesome.
Amazing. So it's Michael Kamen's, it's the whole album. It's his whole deal of all the orchestral movements. It's an incredible thing. It's a beautiful, amazing thing. And so stuff like that. I just got a LL Cool J from Celebrity Deathmatch.
All I can think, every time I think of LL Cool J, I think of Mama Says Knock You Out.
It's easy to
think. I used to roller skate to it.
Roller skating. I liked roller skating. I was terrible at it, but I liked it. Yeah, it's worth watching, dude. You can find it on YouTube. It was hilarious. Who's the biggest sellout, Queen Latifah or LL Cool J? It was really good.
So two more questions for you.
Sure. What do you got?
So you did art, film, music, and writing. Where did the writing come in?
I was unsuccessful at all of them, and I figured throw another one in. You know, hey. Actually, so on STP, I went home and I bought myself a laptop computer, and this was in the beginnings of the internet becoming popular, at least. So I was trying to think, what can I do with this computer? And I'd get onto AOL and I would instant message.
That's how I learned how to run a mixer, was over AOL instant messenger. You know,
I remember I got into a chat room that was about STP. I'm like, I'm actually on a tour bus right now. I'm with STP. And then people are like, "We don't believe you." And I'm kind of like, okay. I'm thinking, like, what do I do with this thing? So I started keeping a journal, which is pretty much the book. And
that's actually how I described it to a couple people. I was like, it's a tour journal. It's daily happenings.
It is. So it's all my journals. It's a copy of what I had going through pretty much daily. I was pretty good about it because I was trying to use this new toy, which was a lot of money for me, having a laptop computer. So I liked writing. And then through the film I told you I did, it was called The Still Life, I met a lot of people. So that film was seen by Spielberg. It was seen by Coppola. A lot of people saw it, and they thought it was cool in that, I made the movie for $24,000. How could you make a feature film for $24,000 with real actors and real music and stuff like that? And they just thought it was neat how their industry was transitioning to enable guys like me to make a feature film. And through it, I met a guy named Michael Grace. And Michael wrote Poltergeist. He wrote Cool World. He wrote Mark for Death. He's a real guy. He's a real writer. And he was telling me for years, he's like, you know, we should work on a project together. And I was like, well, we should write something. I've been thinking about it. And we're going to call it Poltergeist 4. This was before they did it. And he'd be like, yeah, get your freaking code. But he always bugged me, you know, why don't you write a story about being a roadie? And I was like, eh. But I took it to heart. And I actually started working on it a few years ago. And I found it really fun. I was laughing away at stupid stuff. And I really liked it. And then last year I had melanoma. I'm okay, but I had melanoma, and I'm thinking like, man, if I die, I don't, my nephews are going to think I'm lame. So I really got
down. Sorry. That was a funny way of putting it. Not
well, I mean, no one else is out there, and those little dudes will be like, so I figured I finished the book, and I worked really, it's so much. And I finished, I called Michael. I'm like, you know what, man, writing a crappy screenplay is hard, but writing a crappy book is really, really hard, man. Yeah, that's why I've never done it. I'm like, it's really, really, really a lot of work. So I've been working on the audio book now, which I thought would be a lot of fun, but that's hard too. It's really tough. So that's why. But I found the process to be just super, super rewarding. And then when the book hit number one on Amazon and biographies, you know, I'm sitting there looking at my girlfriend, check it out. People like this crap. They think it's great. Amazon says so.
Well, that's something that I didn't put on the review page. I told my friend Jonna, who owns First Angel Media. I was like, look, I said, I got this email. I said, I've reviewed one book. I review some music occasionally. And I'm looking at this email. And I'm like, there's no way. I'm like, there's no way this is good. Why would this guy contact me? And I started reading. I'm like, okay, now I really want to know why he contacted me, because it is really good. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, seriousness. I appreciate it. I put a lot of work into it, so I appreciate it. I've got some really big journalists now who are reading it. And so it's exciting. You know, it's exciting. And when people tell you they like it, I don't know if I care how much they liked it. It's more like, did you laugh a few times? And they're like, yeah, I did.
I definitely did. I read one of the chapter titles while my kids were sitting there out loud. Probably shouldn't have read that one. It was the one about throwing shit at the wall.
My favorite one is the weenie roast a good place to meet a groupie? I laughed at that for days. I'm like, it's the best title ever.
All right, so.
And have fun with it. Yeah, that's what music's supposed to be about. Or maybe life in general. But I mean, you know, have fun. Why Metallica? You know, Sky Michael is writing about Metallica. Yeah, you know, what made you like Metallica? Because it was awesome. That's why. So a little bit of laughter, a little bit of fun in life is, if you can find it, I think it's a luxury. It's great, especially with all the crap going on today, you know.
So my last question, it's probably the easiest one.
Good. I'm ready.
Where would you prefer that the listeners pick up a copy of the book? On Amazon or somewhere else? Or
it's only on Amazon. It's a very easy one to answer there.
Well, there you go.
It's got one place. It's only on Amazon. Amazon makes it really easy. Yeah. Honestly, I don't really buy anything from that. I don't even know how to use it. It's hard to upload your book. I just did a thing for the Music Connection where I tell people how to jump through some hoops of getting your book on there easier, because it's a nightmare. But everywhere so fast, and the price point's good. But I had to set my price point where they tell you. So the cheapest I could sell my soft cover book is $16.99 for them to distribute it internationally. You can pick different numbers, but they just won't work. They won't help you as much. So they kind of set what they want. But then my girlfriend, who actually is a lot more literate, she said $16.99 is actually a normal price for a book. So I was like, oh, okay. I'm like, it seems like a lot to me when you get on eBay and you can buy a book now for like a dollar at the thrift books or whatever it is. So whatever.
I will point out, after I read it, I started Googling to see whatever. After I read it and started my review, I started Googling. I'm like, let's see what other people thought. And we have an Amazon Prime account. And we have a Kindle Unlimited account.
Oh yeah, so you can get it for free if you have that.
Yes. And I was like, I could have read it on the Kindle.
Yeah. And I can't see. I sent you a PDF. I can't do that with Kindle. They're smart. They have to go through Amazon. I can't send it. So, but yeah, if you have that thing, you get it for free. You get one book a month, or you get it for free.
Joel, I want to thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
And everybody, make sure you go to Amazon.com and search Memoir of a Roadie. It's an awesome book.
I really appreciate your time. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Make sure you check us out each and every Friday as we release a new episode. This one was 544. You can find us at buildthescene.com, and we'll see you later.
You've heard their music, now hear their story. From director Frank Marshall, HBO's new documentary, The Bee Gees, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? Chronicles the highs and lows of brothers Barry, Maurice, and Robin Gibb, and the evolution of their prolific career as the Bee Gees. Through interviews and never-before-seen footage, discover how they navigated the ever-changing music industry and complex dynamics of family and fame. Watch it Saturday, December 12th at 8 p.m. on HBO and HBO Max.
Day the lady cried.
She stood in the harbor on a bright September day. The sun from the dawning began to warm her face, and her heart is fair. Trust is everywhere. Majestically she rose, her torch showed us the way. Everyone is welcome to a new American day. Came down from the sky with a bloody crash of thunder right between the eyes. She looked from the distance, a tear fell from her eye. It later came to pass as the day the lady cried. As the darkness fell that morning and grew throughout the day, never had a warning. Since went away, and her heart is mad. Fire in her eyes. People all together, standing side by side, hopeful for the future, knowing wrong from right. And her heart is strong.
Jesus.
This episode of the Pennsylvania Rock Show has ended, but be sure to subscribe to be introduced to more of the best on-sign rock and metal that Pennsylvania has to offer. Don't forget to rate and review the show, and we'll see you on the next episode.